TSMC is at the forefront of driving advanced technology forward. At the TSMC North America Technology Symposium, the company highlighted its latest semiconductor process, advanced packaging, and 3D IC stacking technologies, all designed to power the AI revolution. The showcase technologies are aimed at improving system performance, reducing power consumption, and optimizing design space, all of which are crucial for those working on groundbreaking technological innovations.
One of my favorite genres of political stories is about weird entry-level jobs that lead to positions of power. On the first Obama presidential campaign, the guy who handled everyone's luggage ended up with a desk in the West Wing a few steps from the Oval Office. He became a Massachusetts state senator and even ran for lieutenant governor last year. Donald Trump's body man, the guy who carried Purell and breath mints, ended up in charge of the White House Office of Presidential Personnel. And Washington is filled with powerful people who started out as drivers. Ben Howard was a doorman, but it wasn't just any door that Ben protected. He was the guy at the door for the weekly meeting of House Republicans in the Capitol. And he got to know a lot of GOP members.
That job, you're answering phones, you're setting up for meetings, you're setting up food, you're getting the members of Congress, you know, bagels, donuts.
And eventually one of them, a guy named Kevin McCarthy, summoned Ben to his office for a job interview. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Ben Howard spent 6 years working for McCarthy. In the John Boehner era, Ben was the floor director for then-Majority Leader McCarthy. He ran the House for the man who was in charge of running the House. He's now a lobbyist with the Duberstein Group, and he remains a trusted confidant of the new Speaker of the House.
I used to sit in the office with Kevin. We would dream about this day.
But he's got a bone to pick, because Ben doesn't like the way that you're talking about his old boss. The conventional wisdom about the new speaker is that McCarthy gave up everything to secure that job that he had long dreamed about, and that he's one misstep away from having it taken away from him by his own restive members. But according to Ben, that bit of Washington CW is wrong.
But Republicans think about this stuff differently. They don't tend to just go along with whatever is being considered on the floor.
I talked to Ben in his downtown office to understand the view from McCarthy world. We had a wide-ranging conversation about the state of the House GOP, the debt limit, and McCarthy's relationship with President Biden. Oh, and also about that time he was chewed out by GOP members of Congress for ruining the most famous episode of Game of Thrones. Tell us a little bit about how you got to Washington and how you became one of the most important advisors to Kevin McCarthy for much of your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually a DC native. But yeah, so born and raised in the area. I did an internship at the White House for President Bush.
What office did you work in back then?
I was in the Office of Legislative Affairs. In fact, I was there.
Okay, so that's how you started as a ledge guy and yep. Been one all the way through.
I did, and I.
But you loved it from like early.
I fell in love with it. It is. I think working at the White House is the epitome of the career.
And that was your first job.
And I was a staff assistant, right? And I interned, and then I got hired back as a staff assistant, and I got to watch again some of the best in town and see how they did it and learn from them. So then I jumped up to the Hill, closed out the White House January 2009, more or less turned out the lights and then went looking for a job. Mike Pence, conference chair, hired me as a staff assistant for him. So worked for him for 2 years. You know, look, if there's one thing that I learned from that job, it was to be humble.
Why is that?
I'm so thankful I had that, because that job, you know, you're answering phones, you're setting up for meetings, you're setting up food, you're getting the members of Congress, you know, bagels, donuts. Another staff assistant and I used to push these food carts. It's these huge flatbeds. just, and I mean, with food, you know, packed on this thing, falling off, right, as you're going around the corners in the different office buildings. And there are your colleagues, you know, your friends who are legislative assistants or legislative directors or whatever it may be, you know, walking there as you got, you know, the cranberry juice falling off your flatbed. And it's a very humbling experience, but I am so thankful that I had that experience because I have never taken any other job I've had for granted.
What did you learn about Pence that might surprise people?
Well, first, he always had a great office rule where he would make sure if you were still at your desk at about 5:30, he'd come through the office every once in a while. And he was very family oriented. That may not surprise you.
Yeah,
he would physically walk through the office and ask you why you were still there. You know, and again, he wanted you to genuinely spend time with your family. A lot of those jobs are hard, demanding jobs.
That was the first year of the Obama administration?
Yeah, 2009. And so, you know, that always left an impression on me as well. But the biggest thing I got out of working for then Conference Chair Pence was he had several rules. But the one that's always stuck with me was have a servant's attitude. So didn't matter. You could get the most basic floor-related question. And it was always have that mindset that you're there to help, right? So I've always tried to have that as well. So that job left an impression on me for a variety of reasons.
So many people comparing the current House Republican conference to the 2011 to 2017 Republicans in the last years of the Obama era. You watched an incredible amount of drama during that period. You saw how Boehner was tortured. You saw how Paul Ryan, you know, couldn't keep it together. You saw Kevin McCarthy's aborted attempt to become speaker. Let's go through some of the lessons of that amazing era in House Republican history.
Yeah.
Republicans in the House changed a lot in that era. What were the changes that you witnessed during that near decade?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's important to go back and look at some of how we – I mean, look, perfect example, you have the debt limit coming up, right? I mean, we dealt with that in 2011. Yeah, it's just a little thing. yeah, we handled that in 2011 and got a very up-close and personal look at what that means. And I would also say, look, more than anything – for the new majority, I think it's important for them, and I've talked to them about this, I think it's important for them to go back and look at how we handled some of these issues in the past. 2011, perfect example. So I think our second month in the majority, we did every single appropriations bill under an open rule, right? So that was my second month on the floor working for McCarthy.
McCarthy at this point is...
He's the majority whip.
He's the majority whip.
And I'm the newly minted floor updater, and we get thrown into this situation where we have open rules on every single appropriations bill. And we were there every night.
And remind people why that is.
Sure. It was a commitment from Speaker Boehner that we were going to consider these under an open rule.
So similar to how McCarthy's recent speakership battle, a lot of the debate was not necessarily ideological, but it was over rules and essentially devolving power to members.
Exactly. And so that's why
Boehner faced the same thing.
Yep.
And one of the commitments was
to do these under an open rule. And look, you're seeing the same commitment from Speaker McCarthy to do these. And I think that's, look, one of the big frustrations from members in the House Republican Conference is that we too often lump these sort of big must-patch, you know, legislative items together. And so from their perspective, they want to have a debate on these single standalone bills under an open process. You know, again, I point back, I say, you know, your question was sort of how things changed. I think more than anything, we learned and hopefully have learned from our mistakes during that. I say, you know, some of my own personal mistakes during those years. Hopefully folks can take some lessons from that as well and apply it again. Like I said, you're seeing a lot of the same issues come up now in this majority. And look no further from, and I may get my math wrong on this, but with open rules. So the House just did one last week, modified open rule, pre-printing requirement, which to all your listeners probably means nothing. But what it is it basically allows members to offer any amendment that they want to offer to that underlying bill, so long as they pre-print it in the congressional record at least one day before. And all the same germaneness rules and budget rules apply. But what it does is allows members to submit, offer, can vote on amendments that are important to their district. So what we had last week was a bill, the Strategic Petroleum Response Act, limited jurisdiction, limited scope of the bill. I think it was like a 3-page bill. There were 143 amendments offered to that bill. 143 amendments. Why do I think
both
there were so many?
Both sides.
Both sides, right. Bipartisan.
Yeah.
And for the past three Congresses, we've had zero open rules on the floor. Prior to that, in the 112th Congress, there were 25 open rules considered on the floor, bills considered under an open rule. And then in the 113th Congress, I want to say there were 12. And then the next Congress, 114th Congress, I think there were 8. And the more those open rules go down, the less members have the ability to offer some of these amendments that are important to their district, the more frustration starts to grow among the members, rightfully so. So again, we talk about some of the commitments that Speaker McCarthy made, you know, to become Speaker. My firm belief is that it's actually better for the institution because members have the ability to actually go down to the floor and represent their constituents, which is exactly why they were sent here. And I can say for just knowing Kevin the way I do, this is something that he is passionate about. And he always was. But look, he was never Speaker. He didn't have the ability to deliver and say, like, this is going to be an open rule. That was never his jurisdiction to do so.
If you are Speaker, what's the case for not having an open rule? What does it allow the Speaker to do?
It's greater control, of course. You know, again, maybe on the Democrat side of things, that may be a good thing. I mean, they tend to unite around these issues. But Republicans think about this stuff differently. They don't tend to just go along with whatever is being considered on the floor. Again, we saw that in the Speaker vote, right? I mean, really, what happened on the floor that week has been happening behind closed doors in conference meetings for years.
We just saw it.
It just spilled out in a big way on the House floor.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That is actually how Republicans arrive at decisions in the House, right? As crazy as that sounds.
People hold out. You have to twist their arms.
Yeah.
Make a deal.
Work
and
with
they come
them.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously that happens on the Democratic side.
Look, of course.
Look at the struggles Pelosi had in 2021 to pass the Biden agenda.
And no doubt. And yeah. I actually, when I was at the White House, I had the blessing of being invited at one point to go and watch a Democrat caucus meeting. It was a rare thing, certainly to have a Trump White House staffer inside one of their internal caucus meetings. But we had Bob Lighthizer speaking to them about USMCA. I can tell you, you witnessed a near physical altercation on the House floor. I can assure you that I witnessed one in that room that day.
What happened?
You know, I'll just say that there was a member at a microphone waiting to talk, and another member thought that they should have been in front of that person and used their elbow to push them back.
I think we need some names on this one.
I don't know if I'm at liberty. They both still serve in Congress.
Oh, really? Male, yes. Female?
Both.
A man
one
and
male,
a woman.
One female. Yeah.
Wow. What regions? Let's start with regions of the country.
Illinois, Midwest. Yeah.
Yeah. Both? No, not both.
From both Midwest.
Both Midwest. Same state?
We're getting a little too close to home. I don't want to betray any
last one. The man pushed the woman out of the way or vice versa?
Vice versa.
Oh, well, that's, you know, hats off to her.
Yeah.
He probably deserved it.
Yeah, maybe. And that's fine. But like, point being, everybody has these sort of food fights up there. And
so open rule. So like, all right. If you were Speaker, though, obviously, if you can get away with it, you don't want to have a requirement that every bill has to have an open rule.
Not every bill. Nope. There's something you got to be smart on.
And he's locked into that now. McCarthy's locked into that now, or is there's wiggle room?
On appropriate bills, he's planning to consider them under an open process, an open rule.
Got it.
But on other bills—
Just to remind everyone, some things have been memorialized in the rules package. Other mm-hmm. things are more of a handshake or an agreement.
And some are in the conference rules too, yeah.
Right, okay, right, right. Yeah. This one is where? This is in the conference rules, the rules package, or is more of a commitment in general?
The appropriations commitment is part of the sort of handshake side deal. Just from knowing Kevin, he cares about this stuff. We used to talk about this internally back in the day when we would plan, you know, for him to become Speaker someday, was how he was planning to open up the institution. It's something that he actually cares about and he actually likes. He feels it produces a better result, again, for the country and for the conference. And so, you know, some of the changes, right? We already mentioned considering bills under an open process. I think one thing that people aren't really paying attention to is the use of Calendar Wednesday. It's a niche
what
sort
is this?
Of.
It sounds like an Outlook add-on or something.
It's a niche sort of process, but basically, what it does is if a bill has been reported from committee and the Rules Committee is not planning to take it up, you know, at the direction of leadership, there is a process by which you go through the call of committees on the House floor, and at that point, you know, a member from the committee can rise and offer a bill that's been reported from committee and bring it to the floor. Again. Opening up the institution, right? bills, again, I'm as big of a fan of the Rules Committee as
so you can't all of bottle them. Stuff up in committee.
You can. Now, look, it's a clunky process. And if you consider things on the floor that are not brought through the Rules Committee, there are all sorts of challenges that go with considering that bill on the floor. So this is not like an easy thing to do. But the point is, they have that in place now.
Got it.
And so that change, I think, will be a good thing. I think the 3 days versus 72 hours rule. So what that is making sure that legislation is posted for 3 days versus 72 hours. And believe it or not, there's a difference.
This reminds me of, since you're a Seinfeld fan, there's a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode where Larry, someone says 72 hours, goes, is that 3 days or 4 days? I always forget which one that is.
And we used to have a lot of debates when we would post legislation, you know, at 11:59 at night.
And the clock starts ticking.
Yes. And that counts as a day.
I'm embarrassed to say I was unaware of this difference. So that sounds like a giant pain in the ass, though, if you're the speaker.
It will be. but again, if you're talking about transparency and actually allowing members time and the public time to read some of this legislation, sometimes, you know, in the past, thousands of pages long, it actually matters.
Whose brainchild was this? Was this a Freedom Caucus thing? Was this a specific member? Or has this been kicking around for a while?
I don't know who it was, but it's been kicking around for a while. Ever since we instituted the three-day rule in our last majority, again, going back to that, some of the changes and things we've learned from it, it's been a frustration among some of the members. And again, this is something that Kevin, now as speaker, he actually supports. I mean, granted, look, could it lead to some tough situations if we come up against some of these deadlines? Sure. But do those deadlines ultimately matter to the American people? Maybe not. And I think, look, it's important that there is transparency into some of this.
What's the? There's no enforcement mechanism for that one, though.
Just the members.
Right. Well, yeah.
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 Yeah. And that's ultimately the most impactful. And part and parcel with that is changes that they've made to the Rules Committee.
Explain that.
Yeah. So the Rules Committee is 9 majority members, 4 minority members. You know, they serve at the discretion of the speaker. So the speaker appoints and picks those members. And what they do is they consider and put forward rules that then allow for consideration of bills on the House floor. And the terms and the way that those bills are considered on the floor are dictated in these special rules that the Rules Committee puts out. And so the House then has to vote on and adopt the rules that are kicked out of the Rules Committee before considering that legislation on the floor. You know, may make an order a certain bill with a certain number of amendments. And so the Rules Committee is a highly influential, very important committee on the Hill. And
traditionally, how would you describe the people that the speaker is appointing to the Rules Committee?
A lot of folks, a lot of members that the speaker can trust and lean on. And so one of the frustrations, I think, among the members was that there wasn't better representation on the Rules Committee.
And by design, because it's the speakers.
Yeah.
It's traditionally one of the most important sources of a speaker's power, right?
Yeah.
And so you want your most trusted lieutenants on there.
Yeah.
At any given time in modern history, you look at the majority members on the Rules Committee and you could say, okay, these are some of the closest people to the speaker.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And so some of the holdouts wanted some of those slots this time around.
Right. And so I look, and I actually think in a weird way, and I say this more from my perspective as a former whip floor director who had to deal with whipping rules on the House floor, what this will do by and large, not in every case, but what this will do is actually shift the debate on some of these rules into the committee. And so what they'll have to do in order to pass a rule out of the committee is get everybody on that committee on board. Again, it's a 9-4 split.
In other words, previously, it's a more homogenous group, not as much of a raucous debate about the rule. And then it goes to the floor and it can then be opened up into a problem.
And those things would blow up on the floor and we would have to do damage control and figure out how to pass the rule. And so, you know, look, if you're the floor director for Tom Emmer, a guy named David Planning, you have to be the happiest person around town because
this fight is now shifting to the committee itself.
Yes. And so you're not getting a rule through that committee that, you know, these members don't support. And so again, it's going to solve some of the problems on the floor, thereby making things better for Speaker McCarthy and the majority.
Just to remind listeners, who got a slot on the Rules Committee through this difficult process?
I mean, I think the new members are Tom Massey, Ralph Norman, Chip Roy, Aaron Houchin, and Nick Langworthy. And so if you take the makeup of the Rules Committee, and look at it from an ideological perspective, a political lens, even a geographic lens, it reflects the conference pretty well. And so I think it's going to lead to better results on these rules.
Yeah. Did you ever have that voting against a rule is a big no-no on the floor for both parties? Did you ever have a situation where you had to whip a rule that some folks were going to vote against?
Yes, multiple. In fact, I think there was at least one occasion, I don't remember what the bill was or what the rule was for, where we had to get a Democrat or two, as Kyrsten Sinema, when she was in the House, to vote with us on the rule in order to get it done, which is never the position you want to be in the majority, having to lean on Democrats to basically empower your conference.
Yeah. What are the other changes that you can help unpack?
Those are the big ones. I would add in there more diverse representation on committees. That was another commitment that Speaker McCarthy made as part of this debate. And again, they're just now finishing their committee assignment process. I think there's still a handful of committees to go, but they're pretty much done at this point. And I think if you look at the makeup of these committees, I think they better reflect the conference. And so what does that mean? It means bills that are marked up in committee have to receive the support of a cross-section of the conference that represents the broader conference. And so I think it's going to lead to actually better products for Leader Scalise to put on the floor. I think been plenty of ink spilled about putting Paul Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene on the Oversight Committee, but you know, folks aren't necessarily paying attention to the fact that, you know, Nancy Mace and Nick Langworthy were put on the Oversight Committee as well. And so there's a balance to all of this.
What do you make of the most discussed rule change, the motion to vacate?
Just brought it back to what it always was.
A lot of commentators during this process kept saying that the amount of power that McCarthy had to give up through these changes makes it so the job itself is impossible. And I mean, some people even say not worth having. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration. You don't agree with that?
Not at all. I mean, first off, he's the Speaker of the House. Fact, right? Second in the line of succession, right? I mean, for the presidency, I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing that he's done. And I can tell you, I used to sit in the office with Kevin. We would dream about this day. So for me, it's just personally awesome to see him reach this point.
That's really interesting. So, he literally dreaming about it, talking about like this is going to happen kind of thing.
We'd talk about our plans. Here's how we'd want to do. And so couldn't be happier for the guy. I mean, that one of the main points about Kevin that I don't think people understand. Kevin is just one of the nicest, most genuinely normal people I've ever met with. I mean, like a perfect example. When I started working for Kevin, if he was in town on the weekend, he'd invite people over to go watch football games. And we'd just hang out with him and watch football. On a random Friday night, he'll still call to check in on my son's baseball team. He is truly one of the most genuinely nice and friendly people to be around. So to see him ascend to the speakership is just something I'm extremely proud and happy for him.
Obviously, he didn't want that rule change. No speaker would want that, considering how it was. I mean, you say it was the way it was for all that time, but nobody used it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So
largely dormant.
Largely dormant. Now it's this sort of sword hanging over him potentially. How does he avoid having it used against him?
I love that question. And it gets to just sort of how I know what I know Kevin to be. Kevin McCarthy is first and foremost a convener. You know, the number of times we would go in to prep him, he does a lot of his prep, staff prep work early in the morning, right? So he gets up, he goes to the gym. In the gym, he is working. He is talking to members, right? He comes into the office and we would go in to prep him, you know, 7:30, 8 in the morning, and he'd be on the phone talking to another member. It doesn't matter what point. That Kevin McCarthy thrives off of talking to members. And so he constantly has the pulse. Kevin has always pushed for doing more listening sessions where you reach out to the entire conference, come to this meeting, HC5 in the Capitol, we want to hear your ideas. And this is exactly what they're doing right now on the debt limit. They are bringing members in and they're going to find the center of gravity on this issue in the conference. And so it's same thing, right? I mean, look at what Kevin did with the Commitment to America. He appointed task forces and, you know, he appointed 15, 20 members to each task force based on their expertise, their backgrounds, their committee assignments. To formulate the ideas that the House Republicans would run on in the election last year. And, you know, again, now that they've taken back the House, govern on. But this is just how he operates, and truly trying to incorporate the best ideas of the conference. You know, I think that motion to vacate is going to be less of a problem.
One of the criticisms of him is that he's agnostic about his view of the conference. Is this is the conference he has, he's got the conference that the American people elected rather than the one he might wish he had. And he's very, very pragmatic about living within the boundaries of these are my 222 Republicans. Where he gets a lot of criticism from the outside is if he seems to be agnostic about a Gosar or a Marjorie Taylor Greene or Trump, that he doesn't allow ideology to color his job at the end of the day, which is just to corral this very rambunctious group of people, where the critics will say, wait a second, you've got some extremists here that you need to discipline. That was the nature of the fight between him and Cheney at the end of the day. I think you read most about him is his whole mission is keeping that diverse group of people together and convincing the ones that often give him a headache that they'll be better off, you know, sort of being in the tent, pissing out rather than outside of the tent, pissing in. I think you know what I'm getting at. From your understanding of him, can you sort of help us understand the two sides of that coin?
I think one of the things people maybe don't appreciate about the House Republican Conference is it operates differently than the Democrat caucus, especially under Speaker Pelosi. You know, again, she had her hands in the whip operation. She was, you know, very involved. And look, I mean, this is no disrespect. She was an incredibly successful speaker in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. Powerful speaker.
Yeah.
And her caucus let her be powerful. There was some grumbling for sure. Some. The squad never became the Freedom Caucus.
Right.
Now, maybe down the road that'll happen. But
maybe. Yeah, they seem to be a little behind us in some of that stuff. But
yeah.
But that's not how we've ever functioned. On our side, the whip is the whip. It's his job to pass the bill, right? So
yeah.
I'm referring to Whip Emmer, a Guy Reschenthaler, his chief deputy whip, who is, you know, again, I think somebody that people should watch and look for. I think he's an incredibly talented, hardworking individual, and I think he's going to bring a lot to that whip operation in conjunction with Mr. Emmer. They're the two that are solely responsible for getting to 218. And then Leader Scalise. Again, I worked for him when he was whip as his floor director and know him well. He is a very policy-oriented member, and he has stood up in his office just first-rate policy team led by a former deputy assistant to the president at the White House, National Economic Council, Francis Brooke, who for the White House drove and organized and corralled and led a lot of our policy operations for the White House. And now he's doing that for Steve Scalise. And I would make the point, too, that both Leader Scalise and Speaker McCarthy were whips. They have that mindset,
yeah.
Right? They understand where members are coming from. And so I think you take the whip operation with Emmer, Reschenthaler, and their team, and combine that with Kevin's political sense, Steve's policy background. It's a great blend for success. They can all work well together.
One question this raises, has he through this process, a very, very difficult process of securing the speakership, has he tamed the most rambunctious members in the conference? Or has he emboldened them? The conventional wisdom is that he's emboldened them, so they're going to continue to cause him grief and be a problem until one day the motion to vacate is executed and he goes the way of John Boehner. That's like the conventional wisdom in Washington right now. But listening to you, I think part of what I'm hearing from you is that through this process, maybe the opposite's true. Maybe there's been some release valves turned here, and that he's got a little bit of running room now from his most difficult members, and that it's more taming rather than emboldening. And you might not want to use those words, but I'm curious what you think of that
Absolutely. I don't think it's in anybody's anybody in leadership, whether it's Speaker McCarthy, Leader Scalise, Whip Emmer, Chief Deputy Whip Reschenthaler. I don't think it's in any of their goals to tame anybody. You know, I think,
that's, sure, that's my word. But you,
yeah, I mean, but a harness, I would say, maybe is a better word from our perspective. Because again, I think one thing that all of the leaders recognize is every member has their own unique background, something that brought them to Congress. Again, they all passionately want to represent their constituents. They all have different ways of doing it. And how you put those members in a position to do so, I think, is the key question for leadership. So again, I would say maybe harness.
The White House in this early period is trying to smoke out Republicans and get them to commit to a very specific budget.
Yeah.
Smart from their point of view, right? As soon as you get into – we all know as soon as you get into details, you're subject to attack. Everyone likes, in theory – cutting deficits, reining in spending, but as soon as you get into the details, it gets a whole lot more difficult. Do you have any insights into where they might end up when it comes to satisfying defense hawks, satisfying folks who actually do want to do something about Social Security and Medicare that might not be popular, satisfying some of the promises to be at 2022 levels, which a lot of people think would be impossible without touching Social Security and defense. What's your sense of that debate and where things might be going?
I think we are too early in the process. And I recognize the context in which I'm saying this, which is we're using extraordinary measures and we're in the debate right now.
Yeah.
I think from Speaker McCarthy's perspective, first and foremost, getting the White House to have a conversation about this issue is a win. And I would take it a step further. The White House previously had been messaging that if they have this meeting, it's going to be about a broader array of policy items.
Do you agree that the debt limit should be raised, right? And the second one was, when will you put out your budget?
Yes.
But I see your point. That's entering into a negotiation.
Yes. And going from where they were at a point saying, we're going to talk about a broad array of things, this isn't going to be
right.
Solely focused on the debt limit, to now focus on the debt limit. Go back to, you know, talk about sort of how powerful Speaker McCarthy is. He's just driven the White House into having a conversation, which that's pretty good for a newly minted, you know, purportedly weak speaker.
So you think you can take that back to the conference as a like, look, hey, you guys, I'm doing okay here. I've gotten us to this point.
This is step one of many. I saw one White House staffer quoted as saying this is meeting one of 100, and that is so spot on. But that, I think, encapsulates where they are in this process. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. But a wise man once put it to me, the debt limit is like kidney stones. It's going to pass. It's just a matter of how much pain you have to go through.
As someone who's had kidney stones, I will tell you that sometimes you have to have surgery if it doesn't
pass.
Well,
who knows?
And I won't explain how they do that surgery, but it's not pleasant.
Look, I think the fact is they're in a position where they feel like they're in a very reasonable position. You know, we have $31 trillion, you know, national debt. Like, at what point is it reasonable to have a discussion about our fiscal trajectory, if not now?
How much does it matter on the debt ceiling confrontation that the majority is so much smaller than what Boehner had? You know, if Pelosi wanted to help pass a clean debt ceiling back in the Obama era, you know, she might need 30 votes from Boehner. The Democrats only need a handful this time. From the White House's perspective, that probably puts them in a very much a wait and see mode to see if McCarthy will ever be able to get anything that attracts 218 votes. And I think their view right now is this will just be a huge mess. The internal contradictions in the Republican conference will assert themselves, and you know, come May, as the deadline approaches, a handful of Republicans will join with Democrats, whether it's a discharge petition or something else, and that's how this gets solved because his majority is too slim. And that's a big difference from what Boehner was dealing with.
Yeah. Oh, no. The size of the majority, no doubt, is a huge difference. But I would go back to you know, the point, which is I think anything in this space is going to have to be bipartisan. You know, again, we're having the conversation now as sort of the initial conversation. But at what point – the White House recognizes that again, we're, the position Republicans are in is actually quite a reasonable position. And so understanding that ultimately this is going to have to be, you know, something that both sides can move forward together. You know, and I think you look at McConnell's comments in the Senate, he's well aware, but he understands, though, at the same time, it's going to have to be a discussion between McCarthy and the White House. And it's going to have to be something that can pass both chambers, which, again, by its very nature, our government was set up that way. And I think has served us well in the past and will continue to serve us well that way. It forces the two sides to talk. I mean, that is the perspective that McCarthy and his team are bringing to these conversations, is the government is set up to have these conversations. Let's have them.
Yeah.
TSMC is at the forefront of driving advanced technology forward. At the TSMC North America Technology Symposium, the company highlighted its latest semiconductor process, advanced packaging, and 3D IC stacking technologies, all designed to power the AI revolution. The showcase technologies are aimed at improving system performance, reducing power consumption, and optimizing design space, all of which are crucial for those working on groundbreaking technological innovations.
You have such an insider understanding of these various leadership jobs that we all sort of use, but a lot of people don't quite understand. What's unique about the conference chair?
Yes, the conference chair is responsible for the messaging. Right, it's making sure that all of the members of the House Republican Conference are on the same message. Not always an easy thing to do.
I'm just sort of curious about this because that's one of those leadership jobs that doesn't really get explained as much. People know what a whip does. People know what the speaker does, a majority leader. But is it internal comms? Is it external comms? Is it both?
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is.
You're branding for the whole conference.
Yeah. And it's hard. I mean, you got to think. Like, I think that's one of the things that people don't always get correct about the House Republican Conference. It's an extremely ideologically diverse group of people.
I think we're all realizing that right now.
Yeah. And like, you know, you saw some of that play out in the first week.
Not just
January.
Ideologically diverse.
No, yeah.
Rahm Emanuel, who had a very dim view of his colleagues in the House, used to say, everyone in America is represented in the House.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
He didn't mean that as a compliment.
No, and you can take that any which way. Exactly. I mean, you know, I think, you know, Kevin McCarthy's always had that view too, but in a positive way. It's a good thing to have diverse thought and diverse representation, right?
Did you ever think about working in the Senate, or are you like a House guy till I die?
I'm a House purist. The House is way more fun.
As we all know from covering that, for sure.
Right. I mean, they give speeches in the Senate. Oh, my good friend or whatever. They're not good friends, you know.
Stop. Wait, they're not? What? Yeah, stop. They're not good friends? Right. That's all bullshit? Yeah. So, all right. So you did that for 2 years and then you...
Yes. At the end, I was about done being a staff assistant at that point. It had been close to 3 years and I was ready to do something.
There's
different.
Nothing below it. What's below a staff assistant?
That's it.
An intern.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. So, okay. You know, look, I was ready to move up. But anyway, so I was playing softball and there's a connection here, I promise. I was playing softball for a team called the North State Flood. it's an old California team and...
Wait, is it a professional team?
No, it's in the House Softball League. Yeah.
It's an old California team members?
It was a former Wally Herger team.
I didn't realize that the Congressional Softball League is...
It's huge.
It's huge.
About 120 teams or
and
something
the teams
like that.
Carry over.
Yeah.
So there weren't any
Herger staff anymore. But what there was a bunch of Eric Cantor staff. Right, including the coach of the team was a guy named Chris Vieson, who worked on Eric Cantor's floor team.
Okay.
And so got to know Chris and some of the other Cantor staff such that when it looked like a guy named Kevin McCarthy, who was then the chief deputy whip, was going to run for majority whip. First, it looked like we were going to win the majority. And then, you know, you heard the rumblings that Kevin was going to run for majority leader, as you would after being chief deputy, or most likely would. And it was actually after a game, had one of the Cantor staff, we were sitting there after the softball game and she goes, have you ever thought about working on the floor? And at the time I said, well, not really. But I started thinking about it and, started doing some, you know, outreach to the McCarthy team, to express interest. And look, one of the jobs at conference was I was the doorman at all the weekly conference meetings. So I would get to see all the members. You know, Kevin already knew my face. I would greet him every week at these things. So
this is pre-2010 when you're doing the door?
2009, 2010.
Okay, so before the Republicans take over the House.
Yep.
And what does this job entail?
This was just part of the, you know, I told the food cart story. You know, it more often than not, it was me in there crawling around on my hands and knees, setting up, taping down electrical wire and setting up microphones and setting up coffee and food and pizza, whatever it was they were having for the conference meeting. But part of that was
A networking point of view, what does this allow you to do?
You get to know a lot of people.
Yeah.
But you're also supposed to keep people out of that conference meeting. So it wasn't always
staffers and reporters kind of thing? Reporters.
But there was a time Rosa DeLauro nearly wandered into our conference meeting and had to politely say, I don't think you want to go in there.
Accidentally.
Yes. I think she was going to a different meeting.
So you're also like the bouncer for the conference meeting.
That's exactly what it is, yeah.
Who was particularly friendly and treated you well as a doorman to the conference and who did not?
Yeah, you learn very quickly who takes the time to remember your name and who doesn't. And that was actually something when I went in to interview for the floor assistant position for the next majority whip, Kevin McCarthy, he remembered my name immediately.
He did.
I walked in the door. It was 7:30 at night. I just happened to still be in the office. Pence clearly hadn't come around and said, you need to get out of here. And thank goodness, because I got an email from the McCarthy team saying, hey, could you please come upstairs for an interview with Kevin McCarthy? Right. So I had about 2 minutes to prepare for this interview as I'm walking up the stairs in the Longworth building. And I walk in, Kevin's sitting there doing some work. And he looks up. The first thing he says, hey, Ben. And it's just that immediate, it's like, aha.
You didn't really know him all that well.
Just in passing. Hi. Yeah. But he took the time to learn my name clearly over the 2 years of doing that doorman job. And so that really stuck with me. And the second thing that stuck with me in that interview was, he asked me if I liked Seinfeld, which thankfully I did. And I do. I told him, I said, yeah, I've got seasons 2, 3, and 4 on DVD. And he goes, great. And I was like, well, is that it? And he goes, no, I have a seat. And we ended up just talking for 5-10 minutes. But
what was the Seinfeld question about? Is he a big Seinfeld fan?
But more than that, and in thinking back on it, I realized what he was doing. He wanted to get to know me, right? Yeah. He wanted to see if I was a relatable person.
Did you give him like a favorite episode or scene or anything?
No, I don't think we got off of that real fast. But
do you have one?
I mean, there are some of the classic ones. The soup Nazi is always a favorite. But we got off of that topic real fast. It was on to just sort of figuring out who I was. It was more of a conversation than it was an interview. And again, it dawned on me. It was like he wants to make sure I'm going to fit with the way he operates, right?
Yeah.
Which is he's very much a relationship driven person.
So explain to people when you're thinking about working on the floor, that path versus other paths in house, whether it be policy or other things. What does that mean?
Yep, very few people actually understand what the floor jobs are. I think in this most recent speaker vote, you got to see one of them, which was John Legansky.
Who was next to McCarthy the whole time.
Yes. Yeah. He was my deputy. We actually hired him out of college. The guy graduated number one in his class at Stanford. And he had interned for us and did a phenomenal job. And so we hired him back. And so for a number of years, John was my deputy. He's one of my closest friends in the world. So to watch him.
And he became quite well known because of all the pictures and C-SPAN cameras being close to him.
Right. But
memeified, I'm sure.
But more often than not, people don't know what the floor jobs are. In reality, they're some of the most important jobs up there. So they're broken down different. I mean, the speaker's floor team has a different role and responsibility than the leader's floor team and the whip floor team. And those three offices are the ones that have the dedicated floor spots.
Got it. Okay.
Generally about 3 staff per office. So in the majority, you've got
just
9.
3 staff. Right.
And give or take, right? Yeah. I mean, there are additional spots sometimes.
There are limits to how many can actually be on the floor?
Yeah, and that's for a variety of reasons, right? You don't want to have the floor overrun with staff and members don't want that either. So it is a very, very select group. If I was to boil it down the simplest way, the whip floor staff is responsible for passing bills, right? So the whip floor director, the responsibility lies with the whip floor director, and this is the job I had for Scalise, lies with, you're responsible for getting 218. You have to figure it out. You have to figure out the strategy. And you obviously have a team of people. You've, you know, in the office, you have your policy team, your comms team, your coalitions team. Everybody is there to help. But that whip floor job, everything really revolves around it, how you get to 218. It's a fascinating job, I would argue. It's probably the most fun and most exciting of all the floor jobs. The leader's floor job is totally different. So leader's floor job is running the floor. So by tradition, it's not anywhere in the rules in the House, but by tradition, the majority leader runs the House floor. That includes working with committees to craft the legislation. That includes scheduling the floor. That includes procedurally making sure the committees know how to get from point A to point B. That includes coordinating all of this with the other leadership offices, both, you know, both sides of the aisle. It includes coordinating with the parliamentarians to make sure they know exactly what it is. But everybody takes their direction on the floor for those type items from the majority leader. So the majority leader's floor director is basically down there all day, because obviously the majority leader can't sit down there all day. They've got plenty of meetings and stuff that they're doing. And so that staffer, you know, the floor director or the other, you know, staff on that floor team are the ones who are sitting down on the floor all day, making sure that what the leader intends to happen and what House Republicans want to happen on the floor happens.
So you come from a pretty traditional Republican background, grew up in D.C. I know this can sound like pejorative, but, you know, for lack of a better word, establishment Republican credentials. You worked your way up in the House, and then all of a sudden you're working in the Trump White House. Still on the legislative affairs side, so it's somewhat familiar. Just broadly, what was your Trump White House experience like?
Yeah, I mean, look, first and foremost, I'm
and it was you did two tours there, right?
I did two non-consecutive tours, which you know, that first year took some years off my life.
Why is that?
It was just, again, I've got into earlier, but the hours were rough. Yeah. You know, look, I mean, working in the legislative affairs office is you're taking constant incoming fire from the Hill for what's going on in the White House, and you're taking incoming fire from the West Wing for what's going on the Hill, right?
They're holding you responsible. Like, why can't you?
Yeah,
fix,
yeah, on both sides Congress? Of the ledger, and it's like, you know, after a while, there's only so much you can take of that. But I'll say this: a couple of things. First, working. I am first and foremost a proud card-carrying Republican, and you know, as you know, as we've already discussed, particularly on the House side. I also look, working in the White House is just the highest honor, and so the opportunity to go do that and work in the White House and really help you know, pass and advance some of our priorities was. Again, it's something I'll take away and forever cherish that time. Don't get me wrong, it was tough, right? I mean, yeah. You got into some tough situations, some tough negotiations, but by and large, it was a chance to go and do, like I said earlier, sort of the epitome of the career. And so in 2017, I was a special assistant to the president in legislative affairs, which, you know, again, effectively the job in legislative affairs is to push and advocate for the president's priorities on the Hill in Congress. And, you know, I think it was once described by, I think this was Nick Calio, as an ambulatory bridge across a constitutional divide.
Mm. It's in the book, The White House Staff.
Very good.
Bradley,
you got it. I'm impressed you knew that quote.
It's a great book. I knew him very well. He died not long ago.
I think that accurately reflects the job, because all you're doing all day, you go into the White House, get your marching orders in the morning, and then you go to the Hill and you figure stuff out.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite parts about that job was you're interfacing with every single member of the House Republican Conference, but a lot of the Democrats too, particularly when I went back in 2019 as the deputy for legislative affairs on the House side, which basically meant anything that happened in the House Republican Conference was anything that happened in the House was my responsibility. And bear in mind, in 2019, we were in the minority, right? But we still had an entire legislative agenda that we had to get done, which meant we had to go work with Democrats to advance these priorities through Nancy Pelosi's House. I'll tell you a story. I mean, there was one time sitting in the Oval Office. It was myself, Mick Mulvaney, and President Trump. And ostensibly, President Trump wanted to talk about Justin Amash and some of those dynamics. But what we got into was, you know, I have an opportunity in there, take a minute to talk about what we were working on with USMCA, right? So for listeners, USMCA was the revised and updated and overhauled NAFTA. And bear in mind, there was even a split inside the White House on that about whether or not it was better to pass USMCA or have it as a campaign issue, right, and run on. So it was sort of a constant battle from the legislative affairs perspective and many other entities inside the White House. It was a must-pass initiative that we needed to get done. So I took the opportunity in that meeting just to say, look, we're working on this. We're having conversations. They're going well. You know, and again, knowing that I think President Trump had heard some of the voices on the other side of it, I phrased it as you have an opportunity to get a legislative win through Nancy Pelosi's house. And you could see the light bulb go off in his eyes. Was, really? You really think this is going to happen? I said, well, got to talk about this in one of two ways. Right? You have to talk about this as a win for American workers and a bipartisan win for the country. I said, generally speaking, if you can talk about that way and message it that way, it'll give us the sort of space we need to operate and negotiate and get this thing on the floor in the House. So I walked out of there, sort of no idea, you know, what would come of that, right? But went back to my desk in the East Wing, turned on the TV. He was going to the gaggle on his way to Marine One, and out of his mouth, this is a win for American workers and a bipartisan win for our country. And I thought, holy smokes, here we go. And he kept that message up over the series of several months. And it gave us the ability to move that through the House and ultimately through the Senate and get it signed into law. And I say that in the context of it was an era of divided government. And we were still able to advance some of our priorities.
Yeah.
And how do we do that, right? We spent a lot of time on the Hill working with, you know, our allies, obviously, in the Republican Conference. But particularly, I mean, I was more or less living amongst the Democrats. And so, look, it, sort of getting back to your question, it doesn't really matter where you fall sort of on the ideological spectrum. And I'd like to think of myself as a conservative. You work for bosses that may have different opinions on things, and you as a staffer are responsible for reflecting those opinions and advancing their priorities. Doesn't matter if it's the President of the United States, the majority leader, the majority whip, that is who you work for as a staffer. And so, look, I think you go back to 2019, I think we were actually able to achieve a lot of things. We were able to achieve, you know, again, I mentioned USMCA. We got money for border security, which, by the way, then Leader McCarthy was incredibly helpful in securing some of that and working and getting members on board for that border security package. And was a big part of he was a big part of the reason why we were able to get that done at a time when it may not have been, you know, politically popular in the House. So, you know, we've stood up a new branch of the military, you know, as part of that year. We secured a long-term extension. Space Force, yeah. Yep, in the NDAA. We secured a long-term extension of the Ex-Im Bank. All sorts of things that you know, we did with a Democrat majority in the House.
This raises the question, if you had that same role today, if you could, if you were working for the Biden White House Legislative Affairs, if they could recruit you because of your deep knowledge of the current Republican House leadership, what would your legislative strategy be for the next few months, specifically on these budget issues?
I love the question. And going back to it, I mean, that was when I went back in went back in the end of 2018. And day one, sat down with our team and said, we're going to focus on USMCA, right? And that was a tough one even to drive the White House to because they were competing interests. You had the unfortunately named Fair and Reciprocal Trade Act that Peter Navarro was pushing in the trade space. So we sort of had to edge that one out. But if I was looking at it from this perspective.
I forgot.
How can you forget?
It took me a second.
Yeah. It's just, legislative genius there, but if you were looking at it from that perspective, you know, look, I think there are a number of priorities that let me just back up.
Yeah.
First things first, I think there are lots of opportunities in general in divided government to advance priorities, and I think this White House, I give them credit. I hear from Republican members all the time that their legislative affairs team is present. They are working the Hill. They are engaged.
With Republicans.
Yes. Yeah. And I say that as a proud card-carrying OLA alum. That is exactly what you need to do, right? And I did that when I was on the Hill. I remember I introduced myself to AOC, right? It's like that's what you do, right? You get
How
up there.
How did she respond?
She was ready to get away, but I did my best, right? I mean, my goal is to make myself available. And look, it can be little things too. It doesn't have to be some sort of big package. I'll go back again to you know, give you an example of ways that you can work with the Congress on issues that maybe you don't think about. But going back to 2019, I got a call a Saturday night, which is not abnormal. It was about 10 o'clock Saturday night. And it was a member of Congress calling. He said, I have a problem. I said, okay, you know, what is it, right? I mean, kids are in bed. I was exhausted. It's like, what, you know, what can I do?
We need to bury a body.
No.
Sorry.
No, it was, you know, what? It was, it was a tough situation. And the member had a constituent who had been wounded fighting abroad. And the problem was they were unsure if he was going to survive. And the further problem was his wife did not have an up-to-date passport and could not travel abroad to go visit him, which, again, we didn't know how long he had to live.
Oh, my God.
And so, you know, case in point, it's like, okay, got to kick into gear here, figure this problem out. And so I immediately called the State Department, said, all right, here's the situation. What can we do? And within 12 hours, they had her on a plane over in Germany to visit her husband. You know, I was told there was a happy ending to this, which is great, and he survived. But my point is, it is stuff like that at the White House that you never think about. But you have to have those relationships with, doesn't matter if that was a Democrat or a Republican. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That issue is far too important to have a again, if there was a – if you're not reaching out to – from their perspective, if you're not reaching out to every Republican, you may not have that conduit, right, to call somebody at the White House and go, I've got a problem.
Yeah.
And so those sort of issues – but if I was looking at it from a macro level, you know, some bigger type legislative items, I think there are things that this White House is going to want passed that will be – somewhat heavy lifts inside the House Republican Conference.
Aside from the debt ceiling? I mean, beyond
sure.
The obvious ones?
I think some of these issues on you know, FISA reauth coming up here are going to be tough. I think some of the issues that could come up in a farm bill, which expires at the end of this year, I think there's going to be a vested interest from all sides in seeing these things get passed. So how you marry up and how you get in now, right, on some of these items, how these things all sort of interplay with debt limit discussions, funding bill discussions. It's all sort of connected here. And so if I was them, I would be sitting down, you know, I would have already sat down and thought through, okay, what are our priorities in some of these things and how can we work with House Republicans to advance them?
Do you think there's a case from the White House perspective to sort of go bigger on the debt ceiling, then? In other words, bring in a lot of other things and actually enlarge the issue, creating a larger deal rather than keeping it as narrow as possible.
I don't have any insight into their thinking beyond that memo that they put out.
No. I just mean from as a legislative tactician yourself, thinking it from their, you know, from their perspective. Like, are there any? That's what I was getting at that question. Is there anything that you understand about the headspace of the leadership, of the Republican leadership, that you would be advising them, you know, go this way, you might be surprised at what the results are. Rather than with their current view, which is basically McCarthy's just going to fall on his face and we don't really have to do a lot and we're just going to wait for that to happen.
Wow. I mean, that's an unfortunate angle to take, you know, for the benefit of our country. You know, I would hope that there's a more positive discussion from their angle.
Well,
some of these big priorities that need to get done. And again, they have real life ramifications. You know, so it's more a matter of how much they want to actually engage. And again, we took the angle again, despite a lot of what you saw, we were always actively engaged with the Democrats. And again, I think we were able to pass a lot of President Trump's priorities because of that. And if they're thinking about it the same way, I think there are opportunities.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this. This was incredibly interesting. And I think our listeners are going to love this conversation. I was told that I needed to ask you about one thing, though, and that is relating to Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Now, I noticed you were a medieval studies undergrad.
Did your research, yeah.
So, which seems like perfect preparation for the House Republican Conference. McCarthy had to get a little medieval on some. He's probably going to have to get medieval on Gates at some point. but there was a someone said I should ask you about Game of Thrones and what happened with disclosing one of the all-time greatest episodes of Game of Thrones. To a lot of super GOT fans on the Hill. What happened and what lesson did you learn from this?
Yeah. I don't know if I learned a huge lesson, but going back to the floor updater days when I used to send the emails to all the Republicans.
It's always email. Emails.
Oh, I know. Yeah. We used to, and this is actually something, I mean, Whit McCarthy was very clear. He liked the sort of fun updates. You know, he knew it drove readers. He knew it was engagement with the whip operation from all the rank and file offices. So he used
to. So those emails you were talking about, you throw in like some like fun stuff.
Yeah. It'd be like at 6:30 p.m. we'll vote, you know, X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah. And then I put in a note about how, you know, Steven Strasburg is throwing heat at National Stadium, right?
Like the equivalent of the third section of Playbook.
Yes. And so, but that was part of it. And so I used to put in all these things. And I'm a huge sports fan, DC sports fan. So I'd often put in, you know, something about the Nationals or, you know, the Capitals, or I'm a Penn State grad, so I put in Penn State. But eventually it got to the point where a lot of the offices were wanted to have you know, broader. They, you know, got tired of sort of the sports updates. So I'm a fan of the show The Bachelor. So I put in Bachelor updates and I'd put in, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, as you mentioned, massive. I mean, I've read all the books multiple times, like just love the series. So much fun. I thought the TV show was really well done until they got past the books. But,
oh, wow. So you really like, okay. You're
love
like
it.
A super fan.
But right. I also knew the Red Wedding was coming, right? And so.
I've never read the books. So
read the books. They're so good.
So you know it's coming. You read the book, so it's not a spoiler to you.
Not for me, but anyway. So I came in on a Monday morning, drafted my email. All right, and you know, recall Game of Thrones aired Sunday night. Monday morning, I you know, after the Red Wedding, which you know, if your listeners know,
we can ruin it now. It's years ago. If they haven't watched Game of Thrones by now.
It's a big deal in the story, right? And basically, you know, horrific things happened to the Stark family. I put in there, you know, good morning, unless you're a member of the Stark family. And I think I said, you know, who got murdered last night by the Lannisters, you know, or something like that. And just laid it out in the email and then went on to say, and, you know, today we'll consider these bills and, you know, at this time we're going to vote tonight and whatever it was.
Yeah.
Well, I got back the most passionate, angry responses from members of Congress, not even the staff, some of the staff, but from members of Congress saying, you know, how dare you ruin this for me? I had this DVR'd. I was going to watch it today. I didn't have time. I was traveling, whatever it was. I got all these responses. Oh, goodness. And then I thought, should have watched it. but no, I'd work in all sorts of, it wasn't That's just fun. That. Like I would put in every Friday in the fall.
Did this become public or something? Is that why it's known, the Game of Thrones spoiler?
No, I mean, I assumed, you know, people were on the emails back then and got it. I mean, look, these emails got forwarded all around town.
Got it.
But,
okay.
But like, you know, it's like another one was good. I would, every Friday in the fall, I would put in, you know, for college football, right? Would put in the emails, college football locks of the week is what I called it. The Ben Howard locks of the week, right? It was a joke, right? It was, you know, meant to be funny, but I would exclusively pick against SEC schools. I'm a Penn State grad. Yeah. So I would, and you imagine, like, where's our conference from? Like, yeah. A huge swath of the conference is from SEC territory.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be fun. All right. It's a Big Ten guy I'm going to pick against. So I would lay out at the bottom of the emails, all right, Alabama playing the Citadel. I've got Citadel by 30, right? And we'll send that out. And you can.
And people thought you were serious.
The vitriol that would come back in. And I'd always throw in a pick for Penn State, too. So we had fun with those emails. But yes, that's the Game of Thrones story. And holy smokes, did we get some riled up members on that one?
I love it.
And that's our show. Our producers are Kara Tabor and Afra Abdullah. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Brooke Hayes is the senior editor of audio at Politico. Jenny Ament is Politico's executive producer of audio. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Please subscribe to Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.